like your true crime like you like your coffee,
Red Handed is the podcast for you.
It's dark, intense, and might just keep you up all night.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti. And every week on Red Handed, we break down a different fascinating case.
From the most recent US trials everyone is obsessing over, like Brendan Banfield, Karen Reed, and Ellen Greenberg,
to the most unbelievable stories from around the world, there's nothing we love more than digging into every detail of the cases we cover, getting beyond a basic analysis and cutting to the heart of the story.
Red Handed has over 400 episodes ready to binge right now.
Plus, be sure to check out our weekly sister show, Shorthand, where we unpack everything from the Black Death to Area 51.
If you're looking for smart, detailed true crime with personality, check out Red Handed wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. As shared in part one of her story, Ellie Gargano is an entrepreneur, writer, survivor, and victim advocate from Southern California. She originally began sharing her story of resilience after attending the Las Vegas Route 91 Festival and surviving a gunshot wound to the head. After enduring several surgeries and physically recovering, Ellie began to realize she still had more trauma to digest. After escaping an abusive 9-year relationship that persisted throughout her entire healing journey, Ellie's path of sharing has evolved and now allows her to advocate for domestic violence survivors. The Broken Cycle Media team is so very grateful for Ellie's tenacity, resilience, and willingness to share so much of what came next for her with our audience today.
Eventually, when I did move home with my ex, things were okay, I guess, for a while, but there were still small incidences that would happen. But for the most part, I felt like things are going okay. The focus is on me and my recovery, and it's going to be all right. What ended up happening was he would use my brain injury and what happened at the shooting as a way to further tighten that control. So now if I wanted to go on a girls' trip or on a trip somewhere without him, even drive somewhere without him, it was, well, remember what happened last time? How could you do that? How could you leave me again? That is so selfish. Don't you even know what you put me through the last time? Or it could happen again. That really became the narrative in my head. It's not safe. I can't go anywhere. I began to rely on him entirely for everything. If I wanted to go somewhere, he was always like, I'll just drive you. It's fine. We'll get there safely if I do it. It got to the point where I did not go anywhere without him. But it was disguised as care. And that if he was there, it would be okay. But then I got to the point where I was like, I want to do things on my own. I want to feel independent. I think that that's how the control started to creep in more. I've been paying for this man's life the last couple of years, which was another thing that he did to control me. He said that I owed him for staying with me throughout my brain injury and recovery, so I should take care of him. So that's what I did. Eventually, once I was able to do more on my own, the physical abuse would start again. We had a couple really scary, bad incidences of physical violence where I thought this could be the end of my life. I had started feeling some PTSD and some anxiety from the shooting. So I started going to therapy every week. Also, a psychiatrist. I never told them about the abuse. I always just blamed everything on being in a mass shooting and having a brain injury, which also, those are common symptoms to get afterward, anxiety and depression and PTSD. So I was able to get medication and the help that I needed because of that. My therapist kind of knew a little bit of what was going on, but not to the full extent. I would tell her small things, but I would always minimize it greatly to protect my ex. Like I would say, you know, well, he kind of like pushed me and got mad, but I would never say, oh, he choked me and threw me on the ground and covered my mouth with a pillow. I would just say, I think that he just has anger issues. Maybe we can figure things out. 2019, a couple years after, I decided to make my Instagram public. My ex wasn't really very into that. He was very big on privacy, especially about our relationship. So I didn't open up and start sharing about my recovery for a couple years after my last surgery. I started sharing more openly about the struggles I was dealing with mental health and recovering from a brain injury. I did a couple podcast episodes for the brain injury community. I wanted to share what I was learning in therapy with people. And when I started sharing about my brain injury after the mass shooting on Instagram, I decided to also start a clothing brand. It's called Brave the Label. The brand name is really centered around my story of being brave and resilient through tough moments. It was kind of my way of, after I felt recovered enough, I wanted to do something meaningful with my life and give back, but also something that I was passionate about because this was my second chance at life and I didn't really want to go back to my corporate job. I wanted to do something different. So that's really how it came to be. I would share very uplifting quotes and inspiring messages through the brand. We sell inspirational loungewear, sweatsets that I designed. A proceed of that goes to mental health awareness. However, it got to a point where I couldn't do it anymore. I realized at a certain point, you are living a lie. You are unhappy. You're being abused. You're going to therapy, but you're not telling the truth to your therapist every week about what's going on at home. You can't continue to do this. And it was very hard to even show up on Instagram and share parts of my life when I couldn't even be truthful or honest about what was going on. In all, I started feeling like a fraud. You can't do this anymore. You're lying to people. So I stopped showing up on Instagram for a while. I got him a therapist. I thought that he could get better. I started realizing that this was not going to ever change. It was never going to be good. And I realized how unhealthy I was. I would look in the mirror and not even recognize myself. I hated everything about my life. And it just kind of got to the point where I was like, I just don't want to be here anymore. And I truly thought, he's going to kill me one day if I stay, or I will kill myself because I can't live here anymore. I was hopeless, depleted, and felt like a shell of a human being. But a lot of those symptoms, anxiety and depression, were also being told to me that that was because of my brain injury. So I was very confused for a long time. After being on these medications for years, I started realizing none of my symptoms are getting better. I don't think that this is because of the shooting. And I started being able to tell I had really healed a lot of that through therapy. A lot of the anxiety that I would feel being in public, being in crowds, I had really healed a lot of that through talking about it. So I started realizing these symptoms I'm having are not because of the mass shooting. This is because of the person that I'm living with that is terrorizing me every single day. Once I made that distinction, I realized I don't even need to be on these meds. This isn't even helping because I'm still in this terrible environment that is triggering every day. Finally, in 2023, I realized that I had had enough. It had been 9 years. Eventually, I went to my therapist. I told her, okay, I'm leaving. I had tried to leave many times. I had gone to her. We had made a plan many, many times in the past, but it had never come to fruition. I would always show up the next week and be like, I didn't do it. At that moment that I told her, I'm leaving this time for real, I meant it with every fiber of my being. I knew I was going to follow through that time. And I made a plan with her. She was like, make a go bag, try to get some clothes and things together. I said, nope. If he sees it, he's going to know. I can't do that. She's like, okay, well, maybe you could call someone. So what I did was on my way home from therapy, I ended up calling my mom. My parents actually had already moved to another state at that point. I think I subconsciously waited for them to move to another state where I knew that they would be safe from him to make my escape, because he would always threaten that he knows where they live and that he knows that I would go there if I was going to leave, and he would harass them or he would show up there. So luckily, my mom was going to be in town that next week, just coincidentally. I called her. I told her what was happening. I said, he's abusive. I'm leaving. I need your help when you're in town next week. This was a Thursday and I ended up leaving on a Monday. So there was a few days in between. I said, don't call me. Don't text me. Don't do anything suspicious. Don't come over. Literally pretend like this conversation never happened, because if he even sees a text from you, he's going to be like, what's your mom texting you about? And God forbid if he saw any messages. I called her, and then I also called one of my best friends who lived in the area. I said, I'm leaving on Monday. He's abusive. I need to come to your house so I have a place to go. Don't call me. Don't text me. Don't do anything suspicious in the next few days, please. They both did not contact me until I contacted them on Monday after I had left. I did not lead on in any way that I was going to leave. I knew that it was not going to be safe, that the only way that I was ever going to leave that house and get out of there was to leave without him knowing. I had planned to go when he was going to be at his 2-hour therapy session that he had once a week. I was like, this is the perfect time for me. He'll be out of the house. However, the morning of, he just knew something was off about me. He could tell. So he was being very weird about going to therapy and leaving for the day. He was like, maybe I won't go. I don't really feel like going today. And I was like, okay, fine. I just kind of played it off like, whatever. He was like, okay, well, you know, maybe I'll go, but I'm going to take the dog. It's my dog. But I was like, okay, sure, take her. That's fine. All I wanted was for him to leave so that I could have my opportunity. Because I was like, I cannot wait a whole nother week for his therapy time to come around again. He barely leaves the house. I can't do this. It seriously felt like this is now or never. This is my one opportunity. I have to figure out how to go. And then he was like, no, okay, fine. I'll go, but let me take your car. Fine, take my car. So that's what he ended up doing. He took my car to therapy that day when I was supposed to use it to leave the home. But I ended up calling my friend that I had warned ahead of time. And I said, he took my car. You need to come get me. She was like, I'm on my way. She picked me up. I turned off my location once we were out of the house and blocked him on every social media, email, his phone number, just went no contact immediately and escaped that way.
If you like your true crime, like you like your coffee,
Red Handed is the podcast for you.
It's dark, intense, and might just keep you up all night.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti. And every week on Red Handed, we break down a different fascinating case.
From the most recent US trials everyone is obsessing over, like Brendan Banfield, Karen Reed, and Ellen Greenberg,
to the most unbelievable stories from around the world, there's nothing we love more than digging into every detail of the cases we cover, getting beyond a basic analysis and cutting to the heart of the story.
Red Handed has over 400 episodes ready to binge right now.
Plus, be sure to check out our weekly sister show, Shorthand, where we unpack everything from the Black Death to Area 51.
If you're looking for smart, detailed true crime with personality, check out Red Handed wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right, every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
If you like your true crime, like you like your coffee,
Red Handed is the podcast for you.
It's dark, intense, and might just keep you up all night.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti. And every week on Red Handed, we break down a different fascinating case.
From the most recent US trials everyone is obsessing over, like Brendan Banfield, Karen Reed, and Ellen Greenberg,
to the most unbelievable stories from around the world, there's nothing we love more than digging into every detail of the cases we cover, getting beyond a basic analysis and cutting to the heart of the story.
Red Handed has over 400 episodes ready to binge right now.
Plus, be sure to check out our weekly sister show, Shorthand, where we unpack everything from the Black Death to Area 51.
If you're looking for smart, detailed true crime with personality, check out Red Handed wherever you get your podcasts.
I was so anxious. My body felt like it was on pins and needles with anxiety. I had had his location, so I saw where he was at. He was far away from us at his therapy, so I knew that even if he saw where I was, he wasn't going to be able to come back in time. And then I turned off my location and he wasn't able to track me anymore. The friend that ended up picking me up, I went with her to her house. I also knew in the months prior to leaving that she had moved to a new apartment that he had never been to. I never mentioned it to him. I made sure not to mention that she had moved so that he would not know where she was, because in the back of my mind, I thought, I'm going to need that one day. The friend, she was like, "Do you think we should call the police?" I was very hesitant. I don't know if they're going to even care or believe me or what could even happen. I didn't even know I could get a protective order. I really didn't know anything. My friend that I was with, she was like, "I think we should. It would be good to go and get a report down or just do something." And I said, "Okay, fine." So we end up going to the police station. We meet with this police officer. I start telling him how I had to escape. My ex-boyfriend is abusive. And he's like, "Okay, well, do you want to get a emergency protective order?" I was like, "I don't know. Do I even need that?" And he was like, "Well, do you think he's going to contact you and continue to harass you or anything?" And I was like, "Well, yeah." I had blocked him on everything, but he had already started using other phone numbers and getting his friends to reach out to me and family members. So I ended up filling out some paperwork. He took a report. And when he was asking me what kind of abuse, and I told him physical, and he was like, "Has this ever happened before?" And I said, "Yeah, of course, this has happened many, many times, hundreds of times." His response is, "Well, why didn't you ever report it?" I honestly didn't know it was abuse. I didn't know I could report it if it wasn't happening right then and there. I didn't know that the day after you could go to the police and report it. I just didn't even think to do that. I seriously thought, "Oh, if they don't catch him in the act while doing it, there's nothing that they can do." I ended up filing a report, getting an emergency protective order, which you as the victim have to take the report down to the courthouse and file for a long-term protective order. You also have to then, once you get that paperwork, give a copy to your abuser and make sure that they're aware that they are being served and that they have to show up for court. They were like, "Your friends or family can do it for you." And I was like, "That's not safe. He's dangerous. No one knows how he's going to act. So no, I'm not sending one of my friends that he knows or family members to the house. I ended up hiring a process server, and so I had to have him try to serve my ex the paperwork. Once he served the paperwork, you then have to also take your filled out papers. It's like a pretty thick stack of information that you have to fill out about incidences and who you want to be protected under this. In this case, it's me and my dog. I was also asking for protection from my mom, but that wasn't granted. It's a lot on the victim when you're in such an emotional state to even think about filling this paperwork out. You're already so drained and emotional. It's very taxing on you to do this. I realize how much falls on the victim to submit all the paperwork, go to the police, make a report, show up to court, provide evidence. All the perpetrator has to do is show up and try to defend themselves. I almost didn't go through with it. I don't even want to deal with this paperwork right now and go to the courthouse. I was at the court maybe 3 or 4 times just in that 2-day period, filling out and turning in paperwork, waiting in line for hours because there's a million people there doing the same thing as you and trying to get a protective order. Eventually, I was able to turn in the paperwork. Once you get that stamped and approved, you will receive a court date. And when you receive that paperwork, you have to give a copy to the police. You have to give a copy to your abuser. I did all of that. My mom was able to help me. She ended up staying with me for 3 months after that, just helping me get back on my feet, get a new apartment, move in, also get my stuff out of the place that I shared with my ex. She also went with me to court every month for 3 months, trying to get the restraining order. So she was just so helpful. My mom is very supportive. Eventually, I finally had a court date. It was a month after I had left. That was so scary. I never wanted to see this man again. That whole time, I'm waiting for the court date. I have the temporary protective order in place. So he's technically not allowed to contact me. And of course, he's not abiding by that. He's still trying to reach out to me through various people. And he's calling my mom and harassing my mom. So I didn't feel safe throughout that whole time. Going to court to face your abuser is so daunting and taxing on you. You show up for your date and run the risk of running into him in the parking lot, and God forbid anything happens there. And now I have to sit in the same room as him, not only the same room as him for the actual hearing, but in the waiting room for hours waiting for your time to be heard. 6 hours I'm waiting in the waiting room to be called. And then you have your time with the judge. My abuser knew all the ways around this because he had done this before. And in other situations, he knew that he was allowed to ask for a postponement. Everyone's allowed a mandatory postponement. So he did that. It's granted within a minute, and now I can leave. I felt like it was all out of my control. We would have to go back to court again a month later. So at this point, this is 2 months after I've left. At this court date, he has his sob story about how he's living in his car and he doesn't have any money and I took all the resources, how he's trying to get a lawyer. So the judge grants him another postponement to have time to get a lawyer. So I'm feeling guilty because I had him removed from the home so I could get the rest of my belongings. He's living in his car, supposedly. He has no money, no job. I feel guilty. Up until the point at court, I realized he's still trying to paint me as the bad guy and turn it around on me in front of the judge. At one point, he made me so angry by asking for 2 postponements, I ended up getting really upset with him in the waiting room outside of the courtroom and yelling at him. The sheriffs had to come over and basically tell me, I can't do that. I need to sit down and control myself. So in court, the next time he would say to the judge, can you please ask Miss Gargano not to yell at me outside of the courtroom? Because isn't that the whole point of why we're here in the first place? At that point, I realized the game that he was doing. And it is so frustrating when you're the victim and you're trying to finally share your story and have a voice to have to sit there and be silent and not show emotion, not get angry, not get upset, because if you do, you will look like the abusive one, or it will look like it's mutual abuse. The final time that I went to court is 3 months after I've left. During that 3 month period, he has lots of time to try to get out of this situation. He's done this before. So that's why I was also like very hesitant to go through with it, because I was like, I just feel like he knows too much. 3 months later, September 2023, I finally get to speak with the judge, because the past two times I was in the courtroom for probably less than 5 minutes. So eventually I got to take the stand. Sometimes when you're in the courtroom, you're waiting for your turn, you have to watch the cases that go before you because you're in the room. None of the ones that I saw did the victim have to go on the stand, but the judge asked me to go up on the stand. So I didn't get to just sit facing the judge the whole time and explain what was going on. I had to go up in a seat looking out at my abuser and my lawyer and whoever was in court. I did have a lawyer, which you don't have to do for these kind of cases, but I just ended up getting someone that I had known. So I'm on the stand. I go through, I had printed out probably 30 pages of photos of me with bruises and scratches. Also text messages of him, missed calls from him on different phone numbers, where he's breaking the temporary restraining order. We go through every single picture, every single exhibit, explaining what this is, what happened, who gave you these bruises, who gave you these marks. And I pointed him out and named him. I'm facing him doing this. And then afterward, I'm on the stand. He has the ability now, granted by the judge, to ask me questions. So he's doing everything he can to paint me as a liar, or to create some kind of doubt in the judge's mind. He said something like, isn't it true that we have a 70-pound yellow lab dog that could have given you those scratches? And I was just like, no, I didn't run to the bathroom after the dog scratched me and take secret photos and then email them to myself so that you wouldn't be able to see that. He did also weaponize my brain injury and shooting in court to plant some seed in the judge's mind that I'm mentally and emotionally unstable and therefore have mental health issues. It was awful. It was terrible. Eventually, at the end of it, I was able to get a restraining order for 5 years, which also I don't think is long enough. After this judge granted the restraining order, he looked to me and to my ex and he said, I think both of you have been through a lot. And obviously, a lot went on in the relationship. He looked at my ex and said, thank you for being so honest in the courtroom. I would like to say to you that this is just a restraining order. It doesn't need to be a life sentence. You can still make something good out of your life. The judge, I understand that he should be impartial, but I did not feel that he had any empathy for me as a victim. I was truly in shock. And it just felt like a slap in the face. Then at the very end, he reads out this rap sheet, his charges and prior charges. There was probably 13 or 14 things. And I'm like, couldn't you have just cut to that at the beginning and saved me all of this torture of going through photographs of me and reliving moments in front of this person and having to sit in the same room 10 feet apart from him? You could have just skipped to, oh, these are all your priors, and believed me from the beginning. So it kind of felt like a slap in the face. I couldn't believe it. But then I was like, well, this is what people talk about. The history of his prior and my knowledge of what he had done with previous ex-girlfriends was always very skewed. Of course, he was telling lies about that. But deep down, I knew that something was not right. When we had first met, he was actually in domestic violence classes for anger management. He had told me that as part of getting out of the military after his service, they help out at these classes and help teach them to the public. So he told me that he was teaching these classes Later, I found out that he's actually court ordered to go to them because of the domestic violence occurrences with his ex. When I later found out about that, he also said to me, she didn't even want to press charges, but the police forced her to.
If you like your true crime, like you like your coffee,
Red Handed is the podcast for you.
It's dark, intense, and might just keep you up all night.
I'm Hannah.
I'm Saruti. And every week on Red Handed, we break down a different fascinating case.
From the most recent US trials everyone is obsessing over, like Brendan Banfield, Karen Reed, and Ellen Greenberg,
to the most unbelievable stories from around the world, there's nothing we love more than digging into every detail of the cases we cover, getting beyond a basic analysis and cutting to the heart of the story.
Red Handed has over 400 episodes ready to binge right now.
Plus, be sure to check out our weekly sister show, Shorthand, where we unpack everything from the Black Death to Area 51.
If you're looking for smart, detailed true crime with personality, check out Red Handed wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right, every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.
After court, I never heard from him again. He has continued to abide by the rules of the restraining order, and I have never been happier. I was able to get my own apartment during that time and just start rebuilding my life at 29 years old. I kind of felt like, oh no, I'm in my late 20s. My life is over. I feel like what kept me staying, and I think that a lot of victims feel this way, is the thought that it's too late. It's been 9 years with this person. I might as well just stick with it. I've stayed long enough. This is just the road that I've chosen. I have to live with it now. But it's never too late to make that change, to choose yourself and get out of a situation like that. If you have that strong sense that something is off, I can fairly guarantee you that something is off. For other victims who might be feeling like they're so trapped and so stuck, you can do it. It's going to be very difficult. But the freedom that you feel afterward is just so immense. My life has just unfolded since I've left. Like I said, I got my own place, lived on my own for the first time, which was amazing. I was able to go on so many trips visiting my family and friends, and I was able to focus on my business more and just live peacefully. Nobody is yelling at me or calling me names or threatening me. Also, I'm safe. Nobody has physically harmed me or touched me in an unwanted way since leaving. And I can honestly say it's just been the most amazing time of my life. I feel like after getting out of the abusive relationship, what was helpful for me was still continuing to go to my therapist. And at that point, I was able to be fully transparent about everything going on and really solidifying in my mind and affirming to myself that this is all abuse. Being able to finally share everything that I had been through and labeling it as abuse, labeling it as gaslighting, labeling it as manipulation and coercion. Also, what is interesting to me now and is a reason why I have opened up on my Instagram about it is social media and TikTok, people sharing their own experiences with this was very helpful for me. Especially even the year leading up to leaving, I remember I saw a video or a post about gaslighting, and I had never heard of this term before. And when I read it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is exactly what he does. This is what I experience every single day. And I couldn't believe there was a name for it. Continuing that after I've been out of the relationship, educating myself, I've read a ton of books about toxic relationships, narcissism, abuse, just identifying those behaviors has been really helpful. Knowledge is power, so educating yourself to the fullest extent is helpful for going forward and not repeating the same patterns with new people, but also it's just very validating for your own self to know that, okay, yes, what I experienced is called this. There's a name for it and other people experience it and I didn't make that up. That wasn't in my head like he made me feel like it was. That's also why I have opened up on my own social media. I share resources, I share definitions, I share about my own experience because I want people to feel validated. I also want people to not feel so alone because when I was going through it, I didn't know anybody in my life that had been through it. I didn't have anyone that I really felt got it, that was close to me. Opening up my platform in this way to reach people that have been through violence and abuse has been so healing for me and I know helpful for the people following me. I obviously don't want people to experience this, but it is very hard to explain the experience to people who haven't been through it. On the surface, it doesn't seem to make sense. Obviously, now being out of it for a while and learning the signs and the cycle of abuse, I can see it now and I can identify where abusive behaviors and patterns were arising. But when you're in it, it is really hard to identify that. You're being very confused on purpose by your perpetrator to not have a voice and to question your own reality, to question the validity of your feelings and to not have feelings at all. It's really difficult to explain to people. So sometimes I wish that people knew what it was like so I didn't have to explain the experience. For me, being in a mass shooting and coming out of that incident of gun violence, it did give me some post-traumatic stress disorder. After I had recovered some from my brain injury and I was getting back out into the world, I started having anxiety about being in crowds or at the grocery store and just not being able to find an exit anywhere. I was constantly looking around, very hypervigilant about my surroundings. But then as that started to lessen, I still felt these feelings of anxiety and PTSD. But I realized it was from walking on eggshells with my intimate partner. I think that the two experiences are similar in how they impact the body and our experience, but they're also different because I was able to distinguish between the two. I started realizing, where is this anxiety and fear coming from? It's actually that you're afraid that at any moment, this person that you live with is going to turn violent against you. It's that they might scream at you and yell at you and you don't know what's going to happen next. That's causing you a bunch of anxiety. I would say the PTSD I experienced from the shooting was a lot more isolated. I was able to work on it to the point where I don't feel like it has a major impact on my life. I've worked on it till this day. So this past year in 2024, I went to my first concert since the mass shooting. I hadn't done that in 7 years, but I finally felt like I had gotten to the point where I would be able to do that. And I did, and it was amazing. So I think I've really been able to reclaim what the shooting took from me. But on the other hand, living with an abuser is constant abuse. And so the PTSD from that, it's daily, it's unrelenting. I've actually never shared this on a podcast before, but there are some challenges with navigating a new healthy relationship after being in such a traumatic and unhealthy one. It brings up a lot of feelings of anxiety and confusion, but it is very healing to be with somebody healthy because it heals parts of you. And I actually have met somebody new. I did not want to go on the dating apps, but it had been a while and I wasn't meeting anyone in person. I was like, okay, I guess I will go on the app, but I'm going to be very vigilant and diligent about vetting these guys. And it just ended up working out. He is very kind, exhibits zero red flags, and I made sure of that. I just want to say that that's possible as well. I didn't think that would happen so quickly for me. I was very prepared to be single for a while and I was honestly looking forward to it, but it just kind of happened. There are good people out there. Not everyone is going to be abusive and take advantage of you and your good qualities. That's something else that I've talked about on my Instagram before, is what are the things about me that made me susceptible to abuse? Am I too vulnerable? Do I trust people too easily? Am I wanting to help others too much? I need to be more rigid and less giving right away, and I need to put up more boundaries. I did need to do some of those things, but also only an abuser is going to weaponize those things and use them against you. If you are kind and generous, loving and caring, a healthy individual will not take those things and use them against you. You can still be those things, is what I'm trying to say. I really wish that everybody knew what the experience of intimate partner violence does to a person. I love the quote that says, "I recover out loud because I nearly died in silence." So that's why I share as well, because when you're being abused, you are silenced and you're not allowed to speak up and have a voice. Being away from that now and being free, I share out loud because I think it can help others and it helps me. At this point, I'm not really sure the direction I'm going to go with the business. I've been really focused on my advocacy work on my personal page and just reaching other survivors and victims, giving them a voice and resources. You can find me on Instagram at Ellie Gargano. I also have a website, elliegargano.com, if you want to reach out to me or learn more. I have a TikTok too. It's the same handle, at Ellie Gargano. And then my business is at brave_the_label, or bravethelabel.com.
You are such an inspiration, and I am so grateful that you gave us so much time and so much energy today. I am just so sorry for everything that you've had to face and everything that you continue to withstand.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm just so glad I could do it. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
By the time I looked up and I lifted my head, there is this man at my window pointing a gun at me. He told me to get the fuck out of the car. I wanted to keep him very calm, and I wanted to keep myself very calm because I just knew my daughter was upstairs. At this point, I'm already out in the driveway. I didn't care that he was taking everything. And then when they didn't have any more room, he pointed the gun at my face and he said, "You're going to shut the fuck up until I leave." I waited until he was far enough where he couldn't run and he couldn't catch me. Then I booked it in the house and I just started screaming.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.
Hi everyone, this is James and Dan. We are two-fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. Every week we sit down behind some microphones and share with each other the best things we've found out over the last 7 days.
Yes, so for instance, Dan, did you know that you cannot tie a knot in four dimensions?
I knew that's where I was going wrong. Interesting.
There are all sorts of reasons why, but we would go into them all on our podcast, along with loads of extra facts as well.
That's right. And if you want to check it out, No Such Thing as a Fish is available wherever you get your podcasts.